Continue with a lesson for this morning. It is wonderful to partake the Lord's Supper together. It's wonderful to sing. It's still odd to me to not be singing mixed throughout, but saving it for the end. I understand the reasons, of course. Let's read 1 Corinthians 16, the first four verses. So I plan on just two more sermons out of 1 Corinthians. But these last two aren't really so much out of 1 Corinthians. We'll be using that as our jumping-off point, but they really will get into multiple other texts almost necessarily. 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 through 4. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up, as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. And when I arrive, I will send those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. Paul says, now concerning, to start that off, now concerning this thing, the collection. Paul has said this multiple times since chapter 7, now concerning, now concerning, now concerning. He's responding to questions, sometimes challenges and maybe criticisms from the church in Corinth, from some in Corinth. And a lot of those are pretty contentious things, and Paul is addressing them sometimes quite boldly and directly. I think Paul saved the best for last in chapter 15, the kind of a climax of the letter when he addressed what they had been thinking, and some of them had been believing about the resurrection, that there would be no future resurrection to come. And Paul corrects that, and it seems like the biggest thing that Paul addresses, something so core and central to the gospel. And then in chapter 16, it seems he's just kind of tying some loose ends as he addresses some other things they've apparently written to him about. So they're not as big, and yet this thing that he addresses here, the collection, is pretty big deal historically speaking, and what was going on behind the scenes that you find from different letters and perhaps even a little bit from the book of Acts. What we're going to find is that we have something to learn from this text and what's going on historically with the early church. Here's what we have to learn from this. Sacrificial generosity facilitates unity. Sacrificial generosity helps unity. So we're going to see how and why that is the case as we go, but that's what we're talking about here. Sacrificial generosity, when done well and sincerely, facilitates unity. So we need to do a little bit of history here just to kind of describe it at the outset. I'm just talking about New Testament history here, because I don't want to assume that we're all on the same page in all of this. Some of you have been studying this for years, and you know it like the back of your hand. Some of you can use a refresher. Some of you are quite new to Bible study, and so it's useful to just walk us through what's going on here. We're reading someone else's mail, right? When we read these letters, that doesn't mean we're at a loss to understand it. That doesn't mean there aren't things that we are compelled to obey, but it does present some challenges here. There's a backstory to what Paul talks about here in chapter 16. And the way these passages weave together aren't obvious necessarily when you just read through the New Testament for the first time. And so the Apostle Paul has made journey after journey, okay, spreading the gospel to new places, establishing churches. He keeps going back to Antioch, which is pretty significantly north from Jerusalem, but still far east from like Rome and Turkey, things like that, modern-day Turkey. And so Paul is using that kind of as a home base where he continues to go back to Antioch and then go out again to encourage churches, to start new churches especially. So he's done that a number of times. And on this third journey, as we call it and think of it, it is evident that Paul has made some arrangements with churches that he had already started, churches that already existed. And he has made arrangements for individuals in each church to try to pull their resources, their finances together, so as to provide a gift that Paul would then pick up, that he would collect when he would arrive there, and that he'd also have, in some cases, representatives from those different regions who would join him and deliver that gift, that financial gift, to Christians who were in need in and around Jerusalem. Well, why were Christians in need in and around Jerusalem? Well, there was persecution in multiple regions, but it seems like persecution is especially strong in Jerusalem. Persecution would eventually be something that Rome did. But for the most part, early on, just like, for the most part, early on, it is Jerusalem and the leadership there that persecutes Christians. And so people were being ostracized. People were losing their family connections, and often what came with that is losing your employment. And so their lives were completely turned upside down. There were things like famines that were affecting the region at different points. And so Christians were facing a severe need in and around Jerusalem. They needed relief. And so this gift that would come from these churches that were throughout the world would mean a lot, would be especially needed and helpful at that time. Of course, that's Paul's plan that we can read here in 1 Corinthians. It's Paul's plan, right? But that's not necessarily a done deal. It's just a plan. And this would not be an easy thing to accomplish, to execute. Paul was going to have to physically travel to all these different places. He was going to have to make arrangements, which isn't just shooting an email or a text, but you mean sending a letter, and probably sending someone who could be doing something else to deliver that letter. There was no central Rome mail that you could just tag a stamp onto and send along. It means seeing those churches actually agree to the value and feasibility of this plan. It means Christians being personally diligent in saving money, not just thinking, oh, that's great. We'll do that. And then all of a sudden Paul's there, and let's see if we can scrape something together here last minute for this gift. It would require an intentional, diligent follow-through to make this happen. So a promise from Christians in Corinth and other churches that we're going to follow through on this isn't the same as money in the bank. So they need to prove it. They need to demonstrate follow through. And that's exactly what Paul urges the Corinthians to do. And so he's already arranged things, at least by chapter 16. It sounds like even prior to that, maybe in another letter. And then he writes in 2 Corinthians, which I personally think is the fourth letter that Paul's written to Corinth. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 8, you can turn there. We'll be doing a number of references in that section. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 8, he says, I say this not as a command, I'm talking about this collection, but to prove by the earnestness of others that you love, that your love is also genuine. And in 8:24, so give proof before the churches of your love and of our boasting about you to these men. And in chapter 9, in verse 3, but I am sending the brothers so that our boasting about you may not prove empty in this matter, so that you may be ready, as I said you would be. And then in 9, verse 5, chapter 9, verse 5, so I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to go on ahead to you and arrange in advance for the gift you have promised, so that it may be ready as a willing gift, not as an exaction. So Paul is trying to appeal to their best intentions. He's trying to secure their action. My guess is that he didn't have to write a letter and another letter to all the churches to remind them and encourage them to follow through. The Corinthians are, as we've seen, especially difficult and stubborn and even critical of Paul. And so perhaps they needed more reminders and urging to take part in this gift. And every other time we read now concerning in Paul's letter, it seems to be that he's responding to challenges or misguided questions for them. So I do think perhaps they even doubted the usefulness or the value or the efficacy of this plan. I don't know that for sure. There's some speculation. But verses back in chapter 16, in verses 3 and 4, he talks about some of the arrangements. We'll have someone from your region that you can send with kind of a letter of commendation, and he'll accompany me. Paul's didn't have to do this, but he's making sure there's transparency and accountability dealing with this large amount of money and contributions from different churches. There's people who get to have a part in the delivery of that gift successfully to Jerusalem. And I wouldn't be surprised if he takes that extra precaution because of groups like Corinth that don't seem to fully trust the Apostle Paul. And so perhaps that's why he goes about it that way. I think it's good and wise, regardless, that he does that. But just think how all the planning and effort and reminders that went into this gift. We don't know how Christians in Corinth responded to everything in this letter. We don't know if they repented of the false teaching of the resurrection like that. We don't know all those things. We don't know if they began to be just really reunited after this, or if they continued to resist those admonitions. But here's something you do know. You find out in Romans 15, and we will eventually go there a little bit in the next main point, that Corinth did it. It seems, at least, there's a strong indication that Corinth participated in this. As Paul writes the letter to the Romans from Corinth and says that people in this larger area of Achaia, where Corinth is, but another church, at least one other church was, Synchrea, that the Christians in Achaia, they followed through. And I have a hard time imagining Paul there being in Achaia or being in Corinth as writing to the Romans and saying that it's a success if Corinth hasn't followed through. So that's great. They proved their love by providing that gift. So don't just talk about some good things to do. Don't just say you care about others. Prove it. Matt told us Wednesday, put your money where your mouth is. Act. And if there is a conflict, if there's some reason for two parties or more to feel like maybe brotherly love isn't reigning right now, maybe our fellowship isn't holding together right now, it might be that in giving some kind of gift or offering some kind of service that we're going to need to persuade them that we are not giving and sharing and serving as a kind of give and take. That we're going to make sure that they know that we aren't expecting anything in return. This is just to prove our love when it might not feel like that's there. So prove it. Secondly, notice how the intention is communicated in this gift, that it is a unifying gift. And you have to look at different texts to see this. But in Romans 15, it's really evident. Paul is writing to this church he's never been to, though he's acquainted with some people there, writing from Corinth to Rome, and a church that was mixed with Jews and Gentiles, a church that he's already spoken to them about some of the conflict that arises between Jews and Gentiles, and some very specific things that they needed to be humble about and united in. And so I think he's intentional then in chapter 15 in talking about, hey, I'm writing to you guys. They're obviously not able to participate in this collection. But I want you to know that the reason I can't get to you guys is because I'm doing this collection, which is going to have a meaningful result. Let's read Romans 15, verse 22. This is the reason why I have so often been hindered from coming to you. But now, since I no longer have any room for work in these regions, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain, and to be helped on my journey there by you, once I have enjoyed your company for a while. At present, however, I am going to Jerusalem, bringing aid to the saints. For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. For they were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material blessings. When therefore I have completed this and have delivered to them what has been collected, I will leave for Spain by way of you. I know that when I have come to you, I will come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. So it's clear that the gift meant something. It meant the affirmation of joint fellowship in Christ between Jew and Gentile, or Hebrew Jews and local Judea Jews and diaspora Jews. This would be an expression of unity and of fellowship. Paul explains this some in 2 Corinthians 9, that this isn't just about money here. It isn't just about kind of the concrete and direct benefits that you might imagine. 2 Corinthians 9, verses 11 through 15. He says, "You will be enriched in every way, to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. By their approval of this service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ and the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others. While they long for you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God upon you, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift." This isn't just about relieving poverty, though it is good to do that. This is producing thanksgiving and thankfulness for the fellowship that was extended. So, gifts of service can bring fellowship. Ought to be a part of how we work through conflict. Amid conflict, we may need to hash things out, right? We may need to figure out who was right and who was wrong and why and how. We need to define solutions directly relevant to the conflict, to make restitution, to repent, to reconcile. But acts of service that aren't directly related to solving the problem can go a long way in showing grace and affirming our fellowship. One more point. It ended up coming, this gift ended up coming at great cost. And I don't just mean financial cost, though that is part of it. And so, financially speaking, do you realize that what this meant for some of the Christians in Macedonia? In 2 Corinthians 8, you can just mark that or glance over at that. Paul was challenging the Corinthians to follow through, right? And he tells them about Macedonia, because he's writing from Macedonia. And he tells them, these Christians here, they are in deep poverty. And they begged us. They were eager to participate in this and to contribute. And they contributed, but not just a little bit. Not even just proportionate to their small amount of wealth. They gave beyond their means. They had every excuse to give the smallest or not even participate, but they gave beyond their means. Christians who are themselves being persecuted, Christians who themselves are poor, giving sacrificially. Giving sacrificially. You might feel like it's always a sacrifice to give, right? I don't know. I really don't think so, actually. It is all too easy for me to give something that I had no plan for, because I have far more than I need, and to just really pay for making myself feel better. It is way easy to do that when we are living in prosperity. And actually could be selfish motives that bring me to give. That's true no matter how much it is, I suppose, right? Ananias and Sapphira gave a great deal, but their motives were just to be noticed and praised for their great sacrifice. So it's not really about the amount, but I do think there's an indicator there that when we give sacrificially in a way that we feel it, maybe money that we had plans for elsewhere in some other way, that when we give sacrificially, it's an indicator that your motives are in the right place. Now think of Paul's sacrifice. I mean, I suppose you can think of it in terms of finances, but that's not really what I'm talking about at all. Paul did not, so far as we are aware, and it seems like there's evidence to the contrary, Paul did not make arrangements for his own financial support as an apostle and preacher. He did receive some support from some Christians. He very intentionally did not receive it from others. He worked with his hands to provide for himself and not be a burden to others. He wasn't the preacher who preaches on giving when the giving would mostly benefit him. He was encouraging giving in each of these texts when the giving went to others. That's why this isn't a sermon about the collection. This is a sermon bigger than that. I don't know why, but Acts, the author Luke, doesn't hardly mention Paul's work in gathering these finances. I mean, if you only had Acts, you'd hardly notice it. Paul happens to mention it in one of his trials, that it's what brought him to Jerusalem again. And so there's this one place, Acts 24, verse 17. I'm not going to read it. It's really simple. It's the only one that I'm aware of where Acts even mentions this collection, which seems, again, pretty important. He mentions it to explain to the authorities the circumstances that brought him to Jerusalem, where he was mobbed, beaten, taken into custody by Rome. An attempt was made to kill him, where he would spend years in prison. What I'm saying is this. Paul went to Jerusalem to prove the unity of the church between Jews and Gentiles, even though he would almost get killed and end up being in prison for it. And Acts tells us very clearly, all the way to Jerusalem, again and again, that God tells him exactly what's going to happen. Bad things are going to happen. He's going to be bound up. He's just facing trials in Jerusalem. He's told what's going to happen, and he goes knowing the sacrifice. And so Paul gives sacrificially. But most of all, as we've just taken the Lord's Supper a little while ago, Jesus proved his love for us. I mean, he planned it from the foundation of the world, and he followed through. He proved it. Jesus made sure we knew it was for reconciliation. And finally, it was obviously the greatest sacrifice. And so prove your love for others for the sake of unity, and especially remember the power of this when it comes at great personal cost.